Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company. Today, one of Britain's foremost women travel writers, Sarah Wheeler. From Terra Incognita, travels in Antarctica, to Mud and Stars, travels in Russia. Now she has a new, more personal book about a woman's life on the road. Sarah Wheeler was born in Bristol, England in 1961 into what she describes as a blue-collar Tory family. As she puts it, there was no unconscious bias. It was all conscious. We didn't like anyone who wasn't like us. Yet, perhaps surprisingly, she took off, straight out of high school, age 18, for Paris, where she worked at a ladies' fashion shop for a year. Then she studied ancient and modern Greek at Oxford, graduating with honors. Sarah Wheeler's first book was based on her travels to Greece, exploring the island of Evia and its culture. She followed it with a title about Chile, a country whose cartography fascinated her, 28 times longer than it is wide. She writes about interviewing the national television weatherman in Santiago, as she says, a heroic figure who was obliged to say every day, "Tomorrow it will be hot at the top, cold at the bottom, and warm in the middle." But it was Wheeler's breakout third book, Terra Incognita, Travels in Antarctica, that became an international bestseller. She spent 7 months in the Antarctic, the first woman writer in residence, through an American government program, living with the mostly male inhabitants of the region's scientific research stations. She followed it with a widely praised biography of a member of Robert Scott's expedition to the South Pole, called Cherry, a life of Apsley Cherry Garrard. Sarah Wheeler is the author of 11 travel books, or books about travelers. Her new one, Glowing Still, A Woman's Life on the Road, is her most personal, reflecting on almost 40 years of adventures, from A to Z, from Antarctica to Zanzibar. Sarah Wheeler spoke to me from Edinburgh, Scotland. Your new book, Glowing Still, A Woman's Life on the Road, took shape when you pulled out some of your old travel notebooks, as you say, to see what I had done. How did you react to what you read?
Oh, well, I was rather aghast, Eleanor, at half of it. Of course, I'd forgotten a lot, and a lot of it was in the wild old days. The working title for the book, in my mind, was Nubility to Invisibility. Nubility being when I was out there in my 20s, and invisibility being out there in my 60s, as I am now. And it was reading the nubility part that slightly gave me a fit of the vapours. But anyway, here I am to tell the tale. I was surprised at how much I'd forgotten, and I was surprised at how much I'd left out of the published accounts. And I asked myself, why did you leave this out?
And what kinds of things?
It was often when a story would occur and I would take it a bit further, wondering on the meaning of it and what could be extrapolated from it and whether it meant this or that, rather the more profounder things. I think I didn't have the confidence to carry on with things then. And the other things I left out much more frequently, actually, was the funny stories, which had arisen largely as a result of my own stupidities. And that was easier for me to see why I'd left it out. It's because I was so keen starting out as a writer, Eleanor, for people to take me seriously. And I thought that would prevent them taking me seriously. Of course, as an old writer now, all I want is people not to take me seriously. But perhaps that arc is just the arc of age.
You've said that when you started out in the early 1980s, travel was seen as a good thing, but now it's flat out bad to take off. What are you thinking of in particular in relation to how the world has changed?
Well, three things really when it comes to travel. One, the big one, hydrocarbons. It's terrible to go anywhere unless you're going on a bike or walking because you're poisoning the planet. We all know that. It's morally wrong. Secondly, coronavirus. Now, that's not going to go away anytime soon, these mutating viruses. And sitting in a metal tube for hours on end is just about the worst thing one could possibly do. So there's that. And the third thing is, of course, voice appropriation. The idea is, and it's a good idea, and I endorse it wholly and embrace it, that you can't just go around telling other people's stories because those stories belong to them. And there's a fourth point also, of course, when it comes to travel writing, which is that we've been everywhere. So there's no new places to discover, which there was even when I started out. There were places people didn't know about. So I thought of it as really as the four horsewomen of the apocalypse. And I tried in Glowing Still to trace the trajectory of those things throughout the course of my career as I'd come to understand them.
Where does that leave you? I mean, what does that mean for you in terms of your profession? I mean, this book can trace the trajectory, but it's surely not your last book. In fact, I know you have another biography in the works. So,
well, it's a lot easier to make decisions at my age. I'll be travelling a lot less, and I'll be thinking about the ways that I do travel. The young women starting out will have to make different decisions, and it'll be harder for them. I write about books a lot, literature. I've got a biography on the go, as you mentioned. I'm very interested in life writing, either full length or essays, largely of women who've trod the same ground that I have. When I started out, I felt that there weren't any role models, but there were actually. They were there. I had to look for them, and I tried to celebrate them in Glowing Still. But the question you ask me, I'll be taking a lot of, you know, fewer flights, like most of us, planning things a bit better so that I can go for longer periods and all the rest of it, just trying to muddle through like we all do. I've given up my car as a kind of hopeless gesture towards being on the right side of the line, but I live in central London, so it's not very hard to give up a car there. Nonetheless, I'll claim some moral credit, if I may.
As you say, a thread of memoir runs through the pages of this book, and you use the German word Kindschaft to talk about the fused experience of childhood and landscape. How would you describe your family background?
Working class, English, West Country. I was born in 1961 in Bristol, which is a port in the southwest of England. Used to be a hugely important port. Was the first port at one stage, and then it sank to a bit below Liverpool. And it's still a fairly important city, small by North American standards, about 500,000 people, I think. And I come from a very homogenous blue-collar background. I say homogenous, that is the word that makes the world I grew up in, my kinshaft, so very different from that of my own children. Everybody we knew in my background was like us. We were working class, but everybody had a job. Everybody I was at school with was like us. All the fathers had a job. That was how it was then, of course. The mothers didn't work. And we all had the same shared experience of everything. Of course, what I realised looking back, trying to convey the landscape of what it was like in 1961, what I remember that I hadn't really thought about before was how close the war was. Bristol was a very big aircraft manufacturing centre as well as a port back in the day. So it was very susceptible to bombs and it was very heavily bombed. And I realised that all the adults in my life when I was born, everybody we knew, had this tremendous experience of living through the Luftflotte bombing the city, being woken. My father remembers his father, who was my grandfather, who was an air raid warden, waking my father up in the middle of the night as a small boy and saying, come and look at this. And the whole of the centre of Bristol was on fire. And so they were still rebuilding when I was born in 1961. And that was, of course, the dawn of the high rise. And so it was this tremendously fractured world that was really touted as a new beginning. I was a boomer. I was a baby boomer. And it was a great new dawn. And Prime Minister of the day was saying, you know, never had it so good and all the rest of it. So that was the world into which I was born. And of course, all the countries I was to travel to in the trips I write about in Glowing Still, many of those countries were in that very decade where I was born, casting off the colonial shackles and achieving independence. So when I started looking at it like that, I kind of saw the world that I had been so blithely travelling around in quite a different light.
You said that every member of the family was not only blue-collar, but blue-collar Tory conservative, and that where you were growing up, there was no unconscious bias. It was all conscious. We didn't like anyone who wasn't like us. You write that travel was not on anyone's mind. The adult voices that you heard in your early years expressed suspicion of abroad. You clearly didn't absorb those attitudes, but where did you get the idea that you could become a world traveler?
Well, I think it was partly just wanting to do the opposite. And you've said about we didn't like anybody who wasn't like us. And I absorbed these things as I was growing up, that of xenophobia. And when I questioned anything, there was no good reason given. I mean, we didn't like the Welsh. Wales is adjacent to Bristol. So those were the nearest foreigners. We didn't like them, but we always used to go to South Wales, which, by the way, is exceptionally beautiful, on holiday in a caravan. And when I said to my mother once, why do we go to Wales if we don't like the Welsh? And she said, Wales is too good for the Welsh, Sarah. And I was never given any reason why we didn't like people. And then, of course, it came to people whom we didn't ever meet any people who were more foreign than that, but we knew that we were deeply hostile to them. I don't want to say it was a hangover from the war, because that's giving them some kind of moral license. I think it was just that general right-wing xenophobia that I think is endemic in certain communities. And the answer to your question about why did I then end up going, I think it was to get away from all of that.
As you were saying, when you began to travel and write, role models, particularly female travelers, were scarce. But you did find a few women writers to look to for inspiration, such as the 20th century American novelist and journalist Martha Gellhorn. She was the first female foreign correspondent to report from a number of war zones, including the Allies' D-Day invasion landing on the beaches of Normandy in June 1944. I asked her about it when we spoke in 1993.
I read that you covered the D-Day invasion by locking yourself in a latrine aboard a hospital ship.
Yes. I didn't have any papers. And that was the first hospital ship. The other two hit mines on the way over. Luckily, on the way over, not on the way back. And I got on board. It's a wonderful ramp to say, you know, some people, what are you doing here? And, oh, I just want to go and interview the nurses. It's just a woman's story, which is then regarded absolutely no interest at all and harmless. And then I did. I just locked myself in a toilet until we were on our way. And then all I did was just write about it, what it was like, those, whatever it was, day, night, day on that ship. And the invasion was, I mean, that was one of the most amazing and extraordinary sights ever to be seen, and the ship was very moving, the hospital ship.
Was being a woman ever an advantage in that way?
Well, that time was absolutely wonderful. I mean, we're always pretty good in Vietnam, too, because I said to them, I'm just here for the woman's angle. I'm just writing little women's stories, and so they left me alone. And I speak French, so I found a student, I found somebody, the old Vietnamese could speak French. And so I managed pretty well to just get around, use it as a camouflage. But otherwise, I mean, people say, didn't you find it more difficult to combat things as a woman? I didn't. I never had any permission to go anywhere, but I didn't find that. You don't have permission, you just do it.
Martha Gellhorn speaking to me in 1993. Sarah Wheeler, you said you were ensnared by Gellhorn's blend of reportage and imagination, and you also identified with her as a woman in the field. What qualities attracted you?
Well, for example, in that clip, Eleanor, that you picked out, pretending to be writing Little Women stories, if you fool them when they're trying to stop you, you've won. And I thought that was a pretty tremendous lesson to learn as a woman writer on the road. As an older woman, you're in some ways perceived as obsolete before you've even started. And this too can be used to your advantage, which is an extension of what Martha was saying there. I think I learned from her, whatever situation a woman finds herself in, she has to find a way out. And that's what one has to do rather than be cast down. I was also inspired by what Gellhorn said about the open robe was my first love and my only true love. And I really identified with that. And she said about war. She'd covered so many wars, as you'd indicated. She said at the end, there's neither victory nor defeat. There's only catastrophe. And those were my sentiments entirely. And she also talked about fear and how domesticity was the only thing she was afraid of. And I feel very much like that. She inspired me in so many ways.
Martha Gellhorn is a rare example of a woman war reporter in her generation. She also became a travel writer. If you can generalize, how would you differentiate the ways that men write about travel from the approach that women take?
Well, often men, I think, perceive landscapes as something to be conquered, like the mammoth outside the cave. You hear language of conquering when they speak about their travels and their exploration. I became particularly aware of this quite early on in my career when I spent a long time in the Antarctic. And not only amongst the scientists that were there, but amongst the stories I was reading of the old days, the fantastic heroic age of Antarctic exploration, all those brilliant stories of little wooden ships, the pincers of a floe, and men roped up almost falling down glaciers, down crevasses, sometimes actually falling down crevasses. And I noticed that there tended to be a language of conquering. The idea was, we are going to beat this landscape into submission. There was also, in a lot of male writing, a case of proving themselves to be superior to the landscape. I think of a lot of those books of trekking as men trying to show how dead they can get. And I think women are less interested in proving themselves and showing off in that general way of physical endeavour and more interested in straightforward observation at no cost to themselves. I don't think many women think that if you lose 2/3 of your body weight and cut all your digits off, then you're, you know, a great woman. I think that close observation is something that really characterises almost all the travel writers, the travel writing women who were my role models as I went around. So that was the main thing, really. And sort of allied with that, and something to which Martha Gellhorn alludes, is access to the women's stories, which often are the most significant stories. And you get access because people aren't afraid of you. I have found, for example, I spent 6 months in Chile. It wasn't during Pinochet's dictatorship, but he was still head of the army and lurking around. Now, I learned more about what it is to live under a dictatorship, around kitchen tables, high up in the Andes, with a woman of my age who had a toddler on her knee and a baby in her arms, than I learned from any book. And that's the kind of access that women don't get. I'm keen to tell those stories, and I have told them in Glowing Still, because, of course, I want to give encouragement to those coming behind me, because I hear so often it's too dangerous, and women have been told it's too dangerous since time immemorial, often as a way of stopping them going. And I feel it's my duty as a woman travel writer on the road to dispel some of those myths. I trust those young women to look after themselves, to be sensible, and to do what they need to do to protect themselves and not to put themselves in harm's way insofar as it's possible to do that. And yeah, I wanted to try and bear witness to all of that. And I told some stories about men trying to stop women going, some of which, to my mind, I don't know what you think, sort of absolutely beggar belief. And in an extreme environments like the Antarctic or like war or like mountaineering, it always seems to be to do with the lavatories. It's amazing how many times men use toilets as a way of stopping women going to extreme environments. And I think that that's pretty funny. And I want to encourage readers to laugh at the men who think that's a reasonable barrier to erect.
Well, without digressing too far, toilets have been used to keep women out of boardrooms, to keep sexually diverse people out of other spaces. I mean, there's a long road that goes down that way.
It is a long road, and we must walk it and tell our stories.
Your new book is subtitled A Woman's Life on the Road, and you say that you want to situate your own experience in that long history. You start with someone you believe to be the first female travel writer to have left a surviving record, Egeria, in the 4th century. Who was she? Well, why was she so unusual?
Oh, she was absolutely marvelous. She wrote in Latin, so we don't really know where she came from, but she probably came from the region we now call Spain. And she was on a pilgrimage, or that's what she said she was on, and she was writing letters back to a community of women at home, her friends. The first thing that leapt out at me was how she addresses them. Dear ladies, light of my life, flames of my heart. You know, I mean, you're with her from the get-go. And she's describing what she is seeing. So she goes to the tomb of Akbar, for example, an Old Testament site. She says it's rather old-fashioned. As you say, she's writing in the 4th century, and she says it's old-fashioned. And she tells her girlfriends, well, when you come out of Egypt, it would have been on the left when the Egyptians and the time of Moses and that, and on the right, explaining to make them see what she was seeing, which, of course, is what we try and do as writers, to make the readers see, hear, feel, taste, touch, not all at the same time. And I see her doing it, and she speaks to me, her voice speaks to me over the centuries. And that's the great thing about being a writer, I suppose, you carry on talking after you're dead. And she did have lots of little things that men might have thought were insignificant, you know. Oh, I met this lovely lady today who gave me a bag of apples, and they were so sweet, you would have liked them, the ones like the ones from our orchard. Tiny little dabs of colour, and talks about meeting somebody else that she'd met in the hostel in Jerusalem. And just chatty, informative, conveying a huge delight in seeing the world, not judging. I thought she was absolutely wonderful, and I wish that she were better known.
Egeria used the cover, perhaps, of religious tourism, and there are nowadays so much of that, with package tours to Bethlehem or Mecca, Masada, Fatima's Shrine, people who travel to distant or remote places to find themselves. Do you understand how or why this became such a popular form of travel?
Yes, I think these days it's sometimes called spiritual tourism. That's a phrase I've heard bandied around. I think there's a sense of discovering oneself, as you've indicated, through travel. But unfortunately, that is exactly what one does. And I think people often think they're going to find somebody else rather than the self they know. A very famous Horace phrase I found repeated by a 19th century woman traveller I cite in Glowing Still, Isabel Savory, said, I go to the ends of the earth and behold, I found my skeleton waiting for me in a cupboard. And that is true, that one does find oneself. So there's a kind of anomaly, or maybe a contradiction, I think, in going in search of yourself, because that is whom you're going to find. I think perhaps it started out, the spiritual idea was the leaving the kitchen sink behind, you know, leaving the things that tie us in a very mundane way to our daily lives, and to go in search of a new self. As I say, it's not a new self you're going to find, it's the old self. But I think that there's some illumination that can come along the way. Well, I know this is true, that when you drag the old self home again, perhaps you're going to see things at home in a different way. So I think perhaps the revelation comes when you get back home often for the traveller, and that you see things in a different way. I hope so. I mean, I'm old-fashioned enough to cleave to the view that travel can broaden the mind. As it used to be said, I really think it can, partly because I could see that small-minded childhood kinshaft that I've described was partly because we didn't know anybody who wasn't like us. Had we done so, perhaps we would have been a bit less small-minded about it.
Sarah Wheeler, the Irish travel writer Dervla Murphy, is another woman you found inspiring, and she was fearless and did a lot of traveling by bicycle or walking with a pack animal in all sorts of places. Her first book in 1965 was titled Full Tilt, Ireland to India with a Bicycle. She died a year ago at the age of 90. I interviewed her a couple of times, and this is a short clip from a conversation in 2008. Some of your journeys, you've relied not on a bicycle, but on a pack animal, for instance, when traveling in the Andes or Ethiopia or Cameroon. When you enter into a relationship with a working animal, such as Egbert in the trip to the Cameroon, what's that like?
Well, that's a good point you've made, because in fact, because my first journey, you know, outside of Europe was cycling to India, somehow I've been labelled ever since as a cyclist, which of course I am. But on the other hand, my major journeys really have been on foot with the pack animal in Baltistan, in Ethiopia, in Peru, obviously, Cameroon. And then laterally, I've been back on the bicycle again, Romania, the Balkans, Africa. But on the whole, I think there's more satisfaction in trekking with the pack animal in areas where there are absolutely no motor roads. That's my idea of an ideal journey.
And then you're walking and the animal...
And the animal is carrying your gear, your camping gear and your food and your water and, yeah.
And what kind of relationship do you develop with the animals?
Well, obviously, extremely close and affectionate.
Yeah, I know.
Most of all with Juana in Peru, our mule in Peru. She was a really special character. I was heartbroken leaving her. In fact, I would have brought her back to Ireland, but for the law against importing any equine animals from South America to Europe.
Oh, because you have place where you live in.
Yes.
There's room.
There is. There's room for animals. Mule. Yes.
Dervla Murphy speaking to me in 2008. You knew Dervla Murphy. What made her stand apart from other travel writers for you?
Well, I think you could hear from the laconic tone of Dervla's voice in that clip that she knew every mountain was there to be climbed. What Murphy really cared about was the causes she uncovered on her journeys and went on to write about. She cared about that much more than she cared about the quality of her prose. And I think that sets her apart, and I admire that. When I decided had the idea that I might write this book, I remember speaking to Dervla, and I said, I've got thinking about writing this book about a woman's life on the road. I said, do you think it really is different for women? And she said, well, I'm not sure really, Sarah. She said, sometimes they don't even know if you are a woman. And she said, I remember when I was in Cameroon, I'd been travelling with a fellow for a couple of days, and he drew his face close to mine one evening and said, are you a man or a woman? And I said, goodness, Dervla, what did you say to that? And she said, I lifted up my T-shirt and showed him my tits.
Well, that was pretty clear then.
I miss Dervla.
Dervla Murphy was known for taking her daughter on many trips on bicycle or pack horse, and later her granddaughter. For most of your four decades on the road, you've traveled solo, but when you had small children in your 30s and 40s, you would sometimes take one or the other or both of your sons with you. Was it by choice or necessity?
Necessity. I had to work, and I had to take care of them. But I wanted to anyway. And looking back, it wasn't so bad, although I think you forget all the difficult things, don't you, about child rearing? You forget all the sleepless nights and, you know, it was fine, especially when they grew to be of an age where they would store up memories they could remember. I can recall, for example, partly because I've got a photograph of my second son when he was 4 months old. I took him reindeer herding with the Sami people. In northern Sweden, the Sami occupy an arc across several countries, but these were in northern Sweden. And of course, it's super easy to take them when you're feeding them yourself, because all they want is to be with you, strapped to you the whole time. But yeah, I look back, of course, now, my children now are 20 and 25, and that one who I went sat with me on a sledge with the Sami herding reindeer, he's now 6'5". So, of course, I long to have those days back, like most parents do, and think of nothing but happy experiences of being with them. But I think a lot of women writers out there would, whether they would write about travel or not, understand that it's tough sledding when you earn your living as a writer and you've got small children and you have to pay the bills. So I was very happy to drag them around. And there came a time when they started to enjoy it. And they too became an asset. You know, people love seeing an ambulatory woman with a small child, don't they? It sort of shows all's right in the world. So, and they, you know, they used to, football was a universal language. We used to, if the plastic footballs were available, I'd buy one every day and they'd start kicking it around and small boys would appear from every orifice of the wherever I was staying, house and street, and a game would commence. And I remember in China, we were in a monastery, the most enormous monastery on the Tibetan plateau, and there was a printing work, so it wasn't actually a holy place. It was an enormous a courtyard, and they started kicking around the football while I admired the architecture. And all these young monks flew out like starlings from every door in the courtyard of this printing works with these crimson robes flapping. And I have some of the photographs of that, only snaps that I took at home, of these two little boys and all these young Tibetan monks playing football. So I have a lot of sweet memories, and most of the terrible ones, you know, when things are tough. I mean, you forget, don't you? It's what keeps you going.
I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Sarah Wheeler, from the Sami in northern Sweden to the other end of the globe, you spent 7 months in the Antarctic on the ice shelves, living with scientists at a number of research stations in 1994 and 95. You were there as the first woman writer in residence through an American government program, although this was your second trip. You first went briefly a few years earlier. What was the pull of the Antarctic for you?
The Antarctic is unowned, as you know. It's the only unowned continent. It's unpolluted compared with the rest of the earth. There's been no wars there. There's no indigenous community. There's no people mucking it up or mucking everybody else up. It was a symbol to me, a young writer, of purity, optimism, hope. And those are the things a young writer should be thinking about. It was the pristine, unowned, the ability to have a relationship with a landscape that didn't belong to anybody. There were no people getting in the way. I felt I could write something about response to the human response to landscape in a place that was free of culture. That was something that meant a lot to me, is free of culture.
You write about the discomforts and potential dangers on that trip, things like having to use an ice hole for a toilet, to go back to that subject, but finding it impossible to get warm at minus 89 Celsius. You were even given a board to place under your sleeping bag to prevent a Eurydicean descent into the ice. I mean, was this something that actually happens, or is it an Antarctic myth?
Descending into the ice? Well, no, if you sleep without a board, just on your thermarest, then there's going to be a dip that your body warmth makes in the ice, particularly if you're sleeping on frozen sea, which you often are if you're at a camp around the outside. I remember once throwing a mug of boiling tea into the air, and it froze before it hit the ice, where it shattered in a tinkle. A bit like having children, you forget the kind of agony of it. And of course, I wasn't doing anything dangerous or challenging, like pulling my own sledge. I don't do that kind of thing. And I had great kit. And incidentally, when you do sleep on the ice, on a thermarest or a board, hopefully both, if it's the frozen sea, you can hear the seals calling underneath to one another. It's very sweet music, and I dream about that sometimes.
Oh, were you able to record it or anything?
I did make some recordings, and I did a lot of radio work myself here in the UK, and I did make a radio program. My gear wasn't sophisticated enough to record underwater. People do now a lot, and you can hear those songs of the seals. Whale song is much more famous, of course, but I can tell you, I heard those Weddell seals, and Weddells breed further south than any other type of seal. And I was camping on the ice in September, which is just when the sun has risen. The sun rises in August. And the Weddell seals, the mothers, they make a hole in the ice in the frozen sea with their teeth, and they flop out, absolutely enormous, onto the ice right next to your tent. And because they have no predators on the ice, they're not afraid. They look at you directly in the eye. That was another part of the whole hope and symbolism story for me as a young writer. Anyway, then they pupped there in September, right next to my tent. And Weddell milk has the highest fat content of any creature. And the pups gain 5 pounds in weight a day. And it's like watching dough rise. It was a really extraordinary experience. And one I will never forget.
But there was another challenge that you had to deal with, and that's the misogyny you experienced in the almost exclusively male environment of the Antarctic. In your new book, you describe being dropped off by a plane at a turboprop dash at the Rothera Research Station run by the British. Could you read about that moment?
Yes, certainly. The door of the Dash 7 plane opened, and the now familiar gust of freezing air, freighted with diamond dust, powered into the plane. I descended the fold-down ladder and stood there while the two pilots began to unload and the other passengers greeted hooded figures who had walked over to meet them. Minutes passed. I could see the main base building on the side of the airstrip, a low, long structure with a green roof and a short flight of front steps leading to a door. To my right, a tabular iceberg rippled in a blue haze. I couldn't stand there until something happened, in case nothing did. I walked over to the building, went up the front steps, pushed open the door, which was like that of a walk-in freezer. Again, this was familiar, and entered a corridor through which hairy men bustled. Nobody spoke to me. Nobody told me where I might find my pitch room, or indeed if I had been allocated one. Was I to sleep outside? I was alone among my countrymen at the end of the world. Where was Melville now? I should just explain there that I'd quoted Melville's Albatross earlier. It turned out, and it took me a long time to understand this, that certain personnel within the institution resented the presence of an outsider, especially a woman. and a non-scientist. I thought how unpleasant it is to be locked out, Virginia Woolf wrote in A Room of One's Own. My mind's eye looked down the wrong end of a telescope at all the women through history who'd been shut out from places they wanted to go. 25 men were at Rotherham when I arrived, and a misogynistic culture had set as solid as the bergs in the bay.
Sarah Wheeler reading from Glowing Still, A Woman's Life on the Road. You say from the moment you entered the galley, the men cracked hate jokes and a crude form of sexual harassment continued throughout your stay at Rothera. As you put it, hourly humiliations came my way. How did you deal with it?
Well, looking back, I wonder how I did, but I think that's perhaps the fortitude of youth. Also, of course, one had no choices. Certainly couldn't go anywhere. That was out of the question. I certainly couldn't ring anybody up because there was no phone, and I certainly couldn't send any emails because there was no internet. So I just had to escape into my private world, which is often through reading, and by engaging with the landscape. And I think that actually I turned it to my advantage. I was aware that I had to do that, not to let them win. And of course, in any group of 25 people, there's going to be some decent ones. And there were three or four, notably ones that were a bit older, a bit more mature, and weren't taking the lead from the others. And whilst they couldn't speak up for me, they were able to befriend me. And I think it's kind of given me an insight in all the decades that have unfurled since then into what it's like for women. I mean, in the world I live in, that doesn't happen anymore. So that kind of thing. But it still does happen in some places.
During your Antarctic travels, you stayed in Captain Robert Scott's hut in Cape Evans. The English explorer ran out of food and fuel on his return journey from the South Pole in 1912 and died just 11 miles from a supply depot. You even slept in his bunk. What was that like?
Extraordinary. First of all, you have to remember, of course, that his bunk and the hut at Cape Evans was exactly the same. It had been fossilised, frozen. Everything was exactly the same, from the tins of rhubarb on the shelf of the galley to the reindeer fur sleeping bags and the books on the shelf. There's no deterioration. It's an abiotic zone, so there's no bacteria to make things decay. So I lay down on his bunk, which was exactly the same as it was appears in the photographs that exist now, taken by Scott's extremely distinguished photographer, Herbert Ponting. You can find in any history book. I lay there and I heard what he heard. And more significantly for me, really, I think, I heard what the others had heard when he didn't come back. Now, you mentioned that he and four companions who had reached the South Pole only to have been forestalled by Norwegian Roald Amundsen, and then they marched back and they died on the way back. Now, the rest of the team were waiting in that very Cape Evans hut as the polar night came in. And of course, hope really does spring eternal. And they all write in their diaries of how on a certain night, there'd be a knock at the window and somebody would shout, "They're in!" Everybody would leap up and rush to the door. But of course, they never were in. And what I heard were blizzards throwing stones at the windows, which you could easily think were your friends, in some cases your best friends, coming back alive. And I heard those noises and the wailing wind and how bleak and desperate it must have been as hope ebbed away. And even though, you know, I had a shortwave radio back in my own hut, not far away, and I had modern gear and everything, it still gave me an insight into their bravery. I admired them a lot more for what they'd gone through, I must say. And, of course, part of the reason we know about Scott is he's become the Galahad of the snows, hasn't he? Because he was such a good writer. And by a freak, really, his diary and letters were found when the light came again after that long winter I spoke about when they didn't come back. And those men who were left in the hut went out and they found the tent which had three of the bodies in there. It really is an absolute miracle that they did find that tent. And Scott's diary and letters were in it. And of course, Scott immortalised their plight, their fate, and their courage by this tremendous act of redemption, you know, what we have achieved, and we are a role model for Englishmen to come and all the rest of it. And he was a very good writer. And that has cemented him into the public imagination. I mean, Scott must be the most famous Englishman ever to have lived. Maybe Shakespeare might come close to him, but and that's why, because he redeemed his heroic failure by bringing it all up to a higher level. And I felt immensely moved when I lay on his bunk, when I wasn't trying to keep my heart from stopping from the cold, of course. That was, it was terribly cold and there was no heating in the hut, but I'm as susceptible to anybody of those tremendous stories of heroism and sacrifice for the greater good being the inching forward of human knowledge.
Sarah Wheeler, you visited Russia a number of times when you were in your mid-50s. In your 2019 book, Mud and Stars, you write about the great authors of the golden age of Russian literature, including Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Turgenev, Tolstoy, and Chekhov. Why were you drawn to this group of writers?
Because they're the best, basically, and because I had always wanted to have a chance to write about them, because I'd learned more from them than I had from any other writers, and because I thought Russia was a fascinating country, as they wrote about it, fascinating enough today, and I thought that through their prose and poetry, I could use that as a guide to the contemporary Russia to find out what had changed. So I set off using them as my guide, the various places they've been. In the case of Pushkin, you mentioned, who's one of my top writers of all time, of course. It was his ancestral estates up there in the northwestern corner, close to Estonia. In the case of Chekhov, it was Siberia, where he travelled across the Taiga to get to Sakhalin Island on the other side, on the Pacific coast. And in the case of Lermontov, it was the Caucasus, where he'd served as an officer, where his masterpiece, Hero of Our Time, is set. And so I set off myself to all those places. It's kind of an excuse to go, really, but it was, I thought that they could guide me. And they did. And in terms of what had changed, which is what I was looking for, I would say that turned out to be nothing, because 140 million Russian people today, now they're the 140 ordinary, in inverted commas, people, not the ones we read about in the newspapers. They are battling on with the same terrible conditions as everybody was back then. The lot of the Russian, I think, they've got a saying, you know, we tried our best, but it all turned out the same as usual. Terrible then, terrible now. Corruption at the most local level, going right up to the top. Struggle, battle, and the flame-like human spirit, the dignity of the human spirit in the face of serfdom in the days of my writers, you know, before the 1860s. Tremendous poverty. And a completely collapsed infrastructure in 2018-19 when I was travelling in Russia, which meant life was terribly hard for everybody. And let me say, it's not their war.
It's not their war. No, you say that regular people don't have any illusion about Putin at all. But do you think you travelled there before Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, but you think that attitude persists now, that they know he's a monster, but as you put it, he's our monster?
Exactly that. They do know he's a monster, but they also think that he's their monster because they are fed this constant diet of how everything is the fault of the West. I mean, the invasion of Crimea only happened, according to the news sources in Russia, because of nefarious Western destabilization, the aim of which was solely to invade the motherland and usurp the glory of Mother Russia and all the rest of it. So whilst they do see him for the villain that he is, they do believe he's sticking up for them in the face of a hostile world. But they certainly wouldn't have voted for a war, none of the Russians I met, anyway.
To go back to your companions, these great authors of the golden age of Russian literature, you say that these writers perceive their work and that of their peers as a moral tool, one that helps address the question, how are we supposed to live? Is that a question that you took with you on your travels?
Oh, yes. And I think they're such good writers that they don't come up with any answers, because any decent, I mean, the best writers all know that there aren't any answers. There are only questions. And someone like Dostoevsky, I mean, the answer changed for him, you know, as his thinking progressed. And you get all sorts of different messages from Dostoevsky novels, don't you? Including a lot that he didn't want you to get about doubt, for example. And Turgenev, one of my top favourites, I went to his estate in Spasskaya-Litovinya. He certainly knew that there were no certainties. My book on Russia, which I call Mud and Stars, It's a Turgenev quote. We sit in the mud, my friends, and look at the stars, because, like all the best people, Turgenev knew that human beings are tragically and irrevocably flawed and are never going to hope to do anything more than look at the stars being the eternal truths that are twinkling away out of our grasp. But we can at least look at them. And I think that's what great writers do, is that they enabled you to look at the stars.
You took to reading Chekhov's short story, The Lady with the Little Dog, in Russian as a way to learn the language. Was it successful?
Well, as anybody who reads Russian knows, Chekhov's Russian is actually quite easy, so I'm not showing off here. But I had the idea for that book, I would learn Russian, be my last language, very romantic. And so I did. And my plan was to be able to read a Chekhov short story in the original, which I did do. Now, Lady with the Dog, sometimes called Lady with the Lapdog, is short and it's pretty easy. And I have a great vocabulary now for things like berets. She's famous, she has a beret, and Pomeranian dogs and groin, with a Y, I mean, groin, and all sorts of completely useless things I learned from that book. But that short story, which is, as I'm sure your listeners would agree, one of the best short stories ever written. And again, pretty Russian in its inconclusiveness. But you don't really know what happens at the end. There isn't an end, as Chekhov wanted. You know, the introduction of doubt. And
sadness, too, of course. The melancholy.
Tremendous melancholy. Elegiac melancholy that Chekhov managed to infuse his work with. And of course, when you know how young he died of the tuberculosis that plagued him for so long, that adds a further layer of melancholy. But I still think back with great fondness at The Lady with the Little Dog.
Yes, I have to thank you, because I reread it, because you mentioned it again.
Yeah.
And yes, it is. It's
wonderful.
It doesn't
wonderful. Disappoint,
no,
does it?
No. Even if you learn words like inkstand and lorgnette and beret.
That's it, yeah.
Sarah Wheeler, to return to A Woman's Life on the Road, as with Martha Gellhorn and Dervla Murphy, Sybil Bedford is a writer that you and I both admire. In your book, Glowing Still, you describe visiting a ranch in Mexico, and you say that when you looked out at the landscape, you were seeing it through Sybil Bedford's pages. You call her one of your top writers on Mexico in English. What is it about her writing that you find so compelling?
As Sybil often said, she treated fat Mexico, everybody she met in Mexico, as if it were a novel. And she said that writing about Mexico was like learning to ride a bike. You keep going, you keep going, you keep going, and suddenly you can. And my experience subsequently of writing about place is that you keep going and you keep going and you keep going, and suddenly it works and you get it. And she had that two things. Specificity, she knew specificity was the key to all writing. Describing Glowing Still, her description of being on a train herself, and the window was open and stopped in a station, and a hand appeared, palm extended, bearing a leaf, and on the leaf was a single heart-shaped white cheese. And I think I learned more about the deliciousness of Mexican cheeses from that single image and about how welcome such a simple gesture can be. So specificity, I learned a lot from her, and about that combination so hard to achieve that she did achieve between the close-up shot and the wide-angle lens. And when to twist that lens is the greatest gift any writer can have, really, but a travel writer in particular. And she has it. And she alludes often to the times when it was lonely and difficult, and when all she can do is drink tequila in speechless gloom. And when it's lonely and difficult for me, I try and think of her and how she surmounted her difficulties and wrote off her losses on a page, which is what writers do.
I went to see Sybil Bedford at her home in London in 2003 when she was 92. We talked about her book, The Sudden View, or A Visit to Don Ottavio, among other things. Here's a clip. By the way, you can hear the traffic outside her window. Your first published book, which came out in 1953, was originally called The Sudden View, A Mexican Journey, and then was published as A Visit to Don Ottavio. Yes. And it's a wonderful book. It's a treat to read. It's funny and full of surprises. And it's an account of what appears to be a last-minute journey that you took with a friend.
Which it was, yes.
It was just after the Second World War. You said that you conceived it as a novel. How so?
I didn't conceive it as a novel. The entire Stay at the Hacienda, the entire family is treated as a novel, you know. And I began to see that this is the way this is the way I write. You know, the way, probably my first writing was like somebody trying to ride a bicycle and you can't ride a bicycle and one day you can. And in Mexico, I had some of the conception I wanted to write about Mexico, but I wanted to make it infinitely more historical and descriptive. I never thought I would suddenly run away with all these Hacienda people and so on.
Part of the great charm of Don Ottavio is that the journey is so unplanned and so full of the unexpected.
Yes, but the unexpected happens in Mexico anyway, and you don't have to exaggerate in Mexico. It really is like that. You see, little revolution. Yes.
But is that the way you like to travel, unplanned and full of surprises?
I don't know. I like to see great sights, and I things go smoothly. I'm terrified of things not arriving and buses being late and crashes and don't like it. No, I like to travel smoothly, and I like to arrive in a beautiful Italian hill town in the evening or in a French provincial town and just before dinner and go to the hotel, freshen up, and then have an evening walk and look at all the restaurants and what the menus say outside and like a good dinner. No, I like things to run smoothly. I don't like adventures in that way, but they do happen, you know. I mean, I had car crashes, I had and having very little money, one did sort of long and foolish things like Rome, London, alone in a douche row, you know this time?
In douche row, in that funny little car.
One sometimes really felt it was better to push it along, you know, and walk by the side. And I loved my douche row. And it could be sometimes quite lonely and difficult.
Sybil Bedford speaking to me in 2003. She died 3 years later, age 95. There's such a contrast between the way Sybil Bedford approaches travel. You know, I don't like adventures. I like to stop in the evening and look at the menus at the restaurants in the south of France or Italy, and how you and Martha Gellhorn and Dervla Murphy would all seek out adventures. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a broad church, isn't it? It's a lot to do with class as well in her case. You can probably tell from that recording. There's the entitlement of class that exists, whether you like it or not. And as for food and drink, I mean, she was the most tremendous wine snob. Well, she was a snob about everything, actually, Sybil. But I certainly think that the fact that she travels in a different way to the way Martha did or the way I do, I mean, goodness, there's room for everybody to do things in their own way. And I always say to the young women coming up behind me, if they do ask me for advice, you know, you've got to find your own path and don't be afraid of doing it your own way. And if your own way is seeking out a 1961 Chateau Bechevel to have with your Mexican cheese, because really, my dear, other wine is not worth drinking, then that's fine too.
As we've been talking about, there is an elegiac aspect to a conversation about the future of travel writing, you know, given the environmental and climate concerns, pandemics, post-colonial attitudes. You say if you were starting out now, you wouldn't be able to make the same choices. And you look to the next generation and say you're confident they'll find their own route. How do you see the genre reinventing itself?
I think there'll be other motifs that young women follow, and I think that they will probably do much more travel under their own steam, bikes and on foot, ferries across the English Channel to make a start and get onto the continent, and from there you can get pretty much anywhere. So I think there'll be a great cutting down on hydrocarbons, and I think there'll be an incorporation of the natural world in a way that we might look back and say, well, it had some artifice back in the day because we thought that the natural world would go on forever. And to those young women setting out now, it's very, very real that we are imperiling the planet and it might not be there for their grandchildren. So I think that they have fresh eyes and a great opportunity to respond to landscape that certainly in Sybil Bedford's childhood wouldn't have occurred to her, that it was all going to pot and everything would be flooded and that we were in fact ruining everything even by sitting on that Mexican train. So I think there'll be an attenuated awareness of just what's at stake for young people. And I think that it's important for us to encourage young women setting out on their own path to see the positives of that and to grasp the fact that their stewardship is more informed than ours was, their stewardship, I mean, of the natural world, of the planet.
I'm glad to have the chance to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Sarah Wheeler in Edinburgh. Glowing Still, A Woman's Life on the Road is published by Abacus Books. Writers and Company is produced by Sandra Rabinovich, who's also senior producer, and by Katie Swales. Contributing producer this week was Susan Feldman. The associate producer is Melissa Gismondi, with thanks to Dion Codrington. I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and I'm usually asking the questions, but is there something you've always wanted to ask me? Now's your chance. In anticipation of Writers and Company's finale celebration, I'm inviting you to send in your questions, some of which I'll answer as part of the show's last original program. The email address is writersandco@cbc.ca. For listeners in the Toronto area, tickets are now on sale for this special live event taking place as part of the Luminato Festival on June 16th. Visit luminatofestival.com to book. Hope to see you there. Next week, U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limon. She brings an observant eye and a sense of wonder to all her work. Her latest book, The Hurting Kind, is a finalist for the $130,000 Griffin Poetry Prize. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.